Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, October 1st, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranSorchND for 30 days and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Yes, I had a laminectomy. I did it. I had it on the previous Friday. And let's see. So today is how many days out? Today is this date. And so we are 6 days out. I can't believe it. All that decision to do it, the preparation for it, getting off my supplements for a week, getting my blood pressure down, all of those things. And then the day showed up and Ron took me over there and I went and they did it. And what's so amazing is when you have surgery, the worst thing about the surgery is unless you have a really bad post-surgical outcome, the worst thing is the anticipation. And so I went there. I went to the Lighthouse Surgery Center, and my surgeon was Howard Lantner, MD, and he was lovely. And the Lighthouse was lovely, I must say. If you have to have same-day surgery and you want to go there, it's a place you could go. I was very impressed. It was either new construction or newly renovated because the inside was gorgeous. All the feng shui, the way the waiting room was set up, it was set up with panels and comfy, like couch-like seats in front of the panels that were staggered around each other, and very high ceilings and very calming colors. The floor was gray, and it was the Lighthouse, so the decoration was colors of warm sand and off-white with dark blue accents. And all of the staff wore blue. And blue is a very calming color. And what was explained to me was that they wanted to have the colors be the opposite of something upsetting and be the opposite of red. So it was something that wasn't like red. And so it was these colors, shades of blue and sand. I also thought it was the Lighthouse, so it's going to be colors of sand and blue, which makes it kind of like the beach. So it was a very calming environment. It was similar to when I had my cortisone shot at UConn, where they put you in a bay to start, although instead of being in a recliner, I was on a gurney. I was probably on the bed where they were going to do the surgery. And it was very comfortable. And, I had a cozy cotton Johnny, and I had to put on one of those silly caps and hospital socks. And they took away, they said, you have to take everything off. And they gave me these disposable boy shorts for underpants. So I guess you could bleed on them and mess yourself on them, and then you wouldn't have to take them home and do anything with them. So that was fine. And fortunately, none of that happened. And then, so my blood pressure started out kind of high. I could tell because Taryn, the nurse, was very concerned. And then it went down, and it wasn't high enough that they couldn't do the surgery, because they did. And you have to fast overnight, and fast means nothing by mouth, so no water after midnight. Secret. I had small sips of water overnight. Oops, because my mouth was so dry and I didn't want to wake up and faint. Fortunately, I didn't feel lightheaded or anything going to the surgery. I was pretty as relaxed as I could possibly be. And we got there early. We got there. The call was for 7:45, and we got there at 20 after 7. And they checked us in. The lovely. So I have the names of all of the staff that helped me. So Magdalena checked me in, and she was great. And then I saw Taryn and Amanda preoperatively, and mostly Taryn. Taryn was this lovely petite redheaded woman who was the nicest, sweetest, most calming person, and she was great. And Amanda, I saw Amanda a little bit, and she was just sort of overseeing what Taryn was doing. And then in the OR, I had Dawn, Brittany, and Jamie, and then post-op, poor Chrissy had to deal with me because I was a little loopy. And, you know, I would talk to Chrissy and find out, you know, you've been asleep for an hour. It is very interesting. So I'm lying there. I'm all set to go. And they said, all right, you have to take 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol now. I said, okay. And they gave me some water to drink it with. I said, can I drink all the water? They said, yes. I said, yeah, but we're not supposed to have anything by mouth. He said, it's okay. You could drink the water. It's just water. All right. So I had the 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol. And then eventually the anesthesiologist came in. And just like Dr. Walker, who was over at UConn, this guy, Dr. Kalelos, they said, he is Greek. Okay. Or maybe was it Kalelos or Konelos? It was close to cannoli, so they said, yeah, but he's Greek, which was funny. Anyway, he was a very sweet man, and he explained to me the anesthesia. I explained to him that I had a history of vomiting after surgery, but it was 40 years ago, and the anesthesia is probably really different. And he said, we're going to take good care of you. Don't worry about it. And they did. My mother had instructed me to say, please don't let me die before the surgery, because she always does that. And I said that. And Dr. Kalelos was a little upset, and the nurses just laughed, which is what mom said. Everything happens. And then they wheeled me into the operating theater, and then everything happens really fast. So they wheel you in. Dr. Kalelos is there, or Canellos is there, and all the nurses, and it's very, very bright, and I remarked on how bright it is. They said, yeah, it is really bright in here, and the first thing that happens is they put these big green automatic electrically controlled compression socks on your legs. Then you can feel them compressing and going in and out. And then they hand you a mask, and the mask goes over your face, and they said, all right, breathe this. This is just some oxygen. And it's going to smell funny. And I said, you're right, it does. And then I said, I feel a little woozy. They said, there could be something else in there. And then I had a dream. And then I opened my eyes. And that was it. And I opened my eyes, and eventually I was able to talk to Chrissy, apparently. I mean, I was kind of out of it. And I woke up, and I asked her what time it was. She said, it's 11:30. So I had gone into the operating, and the surgery started at 9 o'clock. So she said, you've been lying here, and you're in recovery. I said, I am, I'm in recovery. She said, yes, you've been here for an hour. I said, no, because you just don't realize. So I thought it would, you close your eyes and then you open them and it's over. It wasn't quite that way for me, because I had this dream, and I do not remember the dream. But I'm wondering if I had the dream while I was in recovery, while the anesthesia was wearing off. Because when you're under anesthesia, your whole nervous system is suppressed. So big shout out to my staff, because they give you a Get Well card. How cute is that? It says Get Well, it has a little balloon on it, and it says Lighthouse Surgery Center. And Magdalena was the woman who checked me in. She was very lovely and efficient. Taryn and Amanda helped me before, especially Taryn is who I remember. She was a lovely, sweet woman. And Dawn, Brittany, and Jamie do not really remember, because that was in the OR. I remember some nice women standing over me, but I don't really remember them, because there was, you know, I was in there for a few seconds and then I was gone. And then Chrissy, I do remember, and she was lovely, and poor Chrissy had to deal with me being kind of out of it. So when I had my surgery 40 years ago for my mammoplasty, I woke up and I said to myself, in order to know that I'm still okay and I still have brain function, I have to do an integration on an equation, because I knew calculus back then. And when I was 20, I haven't used calculus in all that time, so I don't really know it anymore. So I couldn't do that. I woke up and said, oh no, I can't integrate that equation just because I don't know how to. Let's see, what can I do? Well, I can sing some songs. So I started singing two Grateful Dead songs. I sang Broke Down Palace. I got as far as I could through Broke Down Palace, and then I started singing Sugar Magnolia. I don't know how loud or quietly I was doing that, or if I was doing it in my head. Chrissy didn't say anything to me. But I wondered if it was loud enough that people heard and had something to laugh over their coffee with later. So, yes, so the Grateful Dead brought me back too. And then I eventually woke up and I was okay to stand up. I wasn't dizzy. They said, okay, here's your clothes. You can get dressed again. And I had hurt my knee. My knee just blew up on Tuesday, the Tuesday before the surgery. And I'm assuming it was, some version of cartilage tear or meniscus tear or something like that. And so when I came to, and I had to call them and say, are you still going to be able to do the surgery on me? I have this thing with my knee. And Tamika, who was the APRN for Dr. Lantner, she said, we can still do it as long as it's not infected or inflamed or red and hot and infected. I said, great. So yeah, I still want to do it. She said, if you get here and Dr. Lantner sees it and he says we can't do it, then that's okay. So, and Dr. Lantner did check with me one last time. You sure you want to do this? I'm like, yes, I do. I'm here. I've already planned the time off and made the decision. And so off we go. So I had a heavy brace on my knee and I had a hinge brace that I had gotten last year when my knee had gone off. And I had a compression sleeve on the left side, which helps with the paresthesias. And the nurses went to find out if I could keep them on during the surgery or not. And then they were told, no, they have to come off, which makes sense because they have to see what's going on with your circulation. And also I was going to get the compression socks, the compression sleeves while I was in there. So they came off and they said, we'll put them back on you when you're ready to leave. I said, great. So they did that. And then when I woke up, when I finally came to, I felt really good. And one of the reasons I assume that I felt really good is, number one, I had dexamethasone on board, which is a corticosteroid. And corticosteroids, it's to reduce inflammation and swelling, but it also makes you very cheery. So I had that on board. And of course, when you wake up from propofol anesthetic, you usually feel really good, like you had a good sleep and you woke up and you're ready to go. So I had that. They had given me fentanyl. That was one of the drugs that I have, which, as you know, it's I guess it makes you feel good. That I didn't think I was going to get an opioid. I didn't know if I was going to get an opioid because I had explained to them I'm concerned that I'm going to get nausea and vomiting from the opioid. But I had ondansetron on board, which is an anti-nausea medication. So from the moment I woke up to this minute, I have not had a bit of nausea. I am so thrilled. So that means that I can have major surgery. I can have general anesthetic and not have nausea. I'm very excited about that. So I thought it might be interesting to go through all the drugs that I had when I was under. So here's what they give you when you go under. Let's see how many drugs I had. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So over the time of the surgery, I had 12 medications on board. All right, so let me see if I can do this by time. Well, of course, the acetaminophen was given to me. They were the two capsules that I swallowed. That happened at 8:15 in the morning, so that was well before the surgery. Surgery started at 9 o'clock. Looks like the earliest timing for anything that I got was at 9 o'clock. So one of the first things I got was fentanyl. So I don't know if that came through. Oh, it'll say that came through on the IV. And so fentanyl, of course, is an opioid, and that puts you to sleep. That's one of the reasons they give it to you. And of course, it takes care of pain. And then I got propofol. Propofol is the classic anesthetic that's given now. And I got three doses of that, 9 o'clock, 9:07, and 9:10, varying doses. I got ondansetron. The ondansetron was given at 9:20. So that was 20 minutes after I got the fentanyl, and that came through on the IV. And ondansetron is the brand name is generally known as Zofran, and that is an anti-nausea medication. And then all kinds of other stuff. So I'll just kind of run through them. I got orphenadrin, and I thought because it's ended in adrin that it had to do with, it was like epinephrine or, adrenaline, but it's not. Orphenadrin is a muscle relaxant. So I got that. I got lidocaine, of course, which is that's an anesthetic, and that came in right away. That came through on the IV. Oh, actually, this says injection solution. So no, that's not right. So the lidocaine was actually injected locally. And then, because I also had bupivacaine, and that was also injected locally, and that bupivacaine is a nerve block. Anything that ends in cane isn't a local, generally a local anesthetic, but it is an anesthetic in general. Other interesting things, I had cefazolin. Cefazolin is a cephalosporin antibiotic, so they put that on prophylactically. I had ketorolac, which is a powerful anti-inflammatory, and they give that to you. That happened at 10:19 when the surgery was about to be over, so that's probably something they give you for pain. So the ketorolac has always worked great on me for pain. Like when you go to the ER, they usually give you an intramuscular of ketorolac, so I had that on board. And then the other two drugs that were interesting that I haven't mentioned yet are rocuronium, and they give you that right away in the IV. Rocuronium is a neuromuscular junction inhibitor. So what that means is it blocks the neuromuscular junctions. It's probably an anticholinergic, and because acetylcholine controls your neuromuscular junction. So you have your nerves hit the ends of your muscles and they innervate them. They make them so that they work. And they give you this rocuronium to paralyze you, basically, so you don't move. And so the muscles that they're going into don't move either. So they give you the rocuronium, and the rocuronium happened right at 9:00. So they do that right away. And then at the end, they gave me Bridion, and Bridion is right before I woke up, or right before they were absolutely done, because that happened at 10:28 a.m. So Bridion is Sugomax or something like that. But anyway, Bridion undoes the activity of the rocuronium, and it's an anti-muscle relaxant. It undoes the activity of muscle relaxants. So they wake you up so that you can move again. And those are all the drugs I had. I had no idea that when you have a surgery, that they put the anesthesiologist gives you so much different medications. And this is just for an hour and change long procedure. So I was in the operating room for, I guess, an hour and a half total, because they did two spinal levels. So what Dr. Lantner did is he went in and he cleaned up. He told me, I saw him at the end very briefly because he was busy. He had two other surgeries to attend to. And he told me that there was nothing unplanned, and it went very routinely. And he went in and he cleaned out some of the some of the things that were sitting on my spinal column, and cleaned out the calcifications, and probably, I'm assuming, some of the, if there was any, you know, disc debris, cleaned that out, and it all went just fine. And so that was kind of exciting. So when I woke up, I felt pretty good. And I said to Ron, and I was hungry and thirsty. I was not nauseous at all. They offered me crackers and ginger ale. I said, I had brought watermelon water and a protein shake. I said, I'll have that. The crackers are probably not gluten-free, right? And they said, yeah, but you don't have marked here that you have to avoid gluten. I'm like, that's true. I forgot to do that. But I didn't wind up having the crackers. But when I got myself dressed, I got in the car. I said, Ron, take me to Glastonbury. And we went to Glastonbury, and I had a matcha latte. And we went to Dee's One Smart Cookie. And I went into Whole Foods, because by that time I had to go to the bathroom. I picked up a few things at Whole Foods. So this is the day of the surgery. And then I said, I need some puppy therapy. So we went to Bicycles East and saw Deb and Steve. And I got to pet Gage, who is the delightful golden doodle. And it was very good to have puppy therapy. And then we went back home and towards Willimantic, where I was given post-op medications. And what they gave me, what they prescribed for me, first of all, they said, take Tylenol. You can take Tylenol. So I've been taking Tylenol. Acetaminophen, just plain acetaminophen. What they gave me was Percocet, or the generic Percocet, which is acetaminophen plus oxycodone. I have not touched it. I wanted to see if I could get away with not doing opioids, and so far so good, because all opioids do is they calm pain and they make you sleep. And I didn't want to be woozy, and I was afraid they would make me nauseous, so I have the meds. I haven't touched them. So what I have, but I do have separate oxycodone that I can also take if I need it. But my pain has been, it's nagging and achy, but it's not enough to stop me from doing stuff. Like here I am making my show. I'm pretty okay. I mean, I still have pain. If I had to see patients today, I wouldn't be happy doing that. I still need to rest in between stuff that I do. But they want you up and around and moving. I mean, not constantly, but up and around and moving some so you don't get blood clots. So that's been successful. And so that's why I'm doing light things. I thought making my show, it's almost a week after the surgery, so I thought it would be nice to make the show. So I'm doing that, and I have been to the office every day since a couple days after, so I can just do charts and accounting and stuff like that. So I'm moving a little, I am getting a lot of rest. I am doing a bit of lying around and blasting through library books, which is great, and catching up on some trashy TV, which is good. And I'm getting a lot of much needed rest that I've needed over time. So the meds that I have, so been taking acetaminophen, I've been taking, I asked them to give me tizanidine. They were going to give me methocarbamol, which is a muscle relaxant. I said, give me tizanidine because I've taken it before. I do well with it. And you, if you give me the tablets, I can break them and I can have them through the day if I need to. And he did. So he gave me a big bottle of tizanidine. So I've been taking them every single day, or if I'm taking them, I'm taking 2 to 4 milligrams in a day, and the pills are 4 milligrams. And since I've been going out, what I try to do is not take any tizanidine before I go out. And I might have been having a little bit of something else on board. And that product does not cause nausea. In fact, well, it can cause nausea in some people, but it can cause, more likely causes you to be hungry. So I've had some of that as well, without getting into it too much. So those three medications are what I've been taking. Now, I was not permitted to take my supplements for a week before the surgery, so I stopped doing those. I took a very few things that don't interfere with clotting. So I still took chlorella, a little bit of magnesium. I took my probiotic. I took phosphatidylserine, and I took my motherwort to keep my heart calm. And that was mostly what I took, and very little bit of vitamin A and vitamin D. And Dr. Lantner said 2 days after your surgery, you can start taking your supplements again. And that was the same thing that Dr. LaGuardia said. And Dr. LaGuardia cautioned me, why don't you wait for 4 days after the surgery for the natokinase? So I did that and waited for 4 days after the natokinase. Now I'm back on the natokinase. So not only am I up and about and doing some movement, I'm not doing any formal exercise. I'm not doing yoga because lying and twisting and moving about like that, even if it's restorative, I can't really do it. I might try. The thing is, generally when you do a restorative practice, there's twisting involved, and I can't twist my back right now. So I haven't been doing much of anything. What I may do is just some exercises that actually move my legs, like sitting on the side of my bed and lifting my legs up and down. That I can do, and I can walk. So I walk around the house, I walk to the office. I did Rosh Hashanah. I went to Tashlich and saw everybody, but I did Rosh Hashanah by Zoom at home. So Shana Tova, if you are celebrating, happy 5786. So it's been interesting. What I am concerned, because I still have the nerve discomfort in my left leg. What I'm hoping is that's going to go away once, because I have swelling and inflammation at the surgical site. I certainly do, because I still have pain there and the surgical site has to heal. So there's still pressure on the nerve because there's swelling where he did the surgery. So I'm hoping that in time that this nerve pain will dissipate, because it's still definitely there. It's not, I heard that some people, they wake up and their nerve pain is gone. That is definitely not true for me. It's still very much there. I mean, it's not extreme nerve pain. It's not like when I had the acute flare of the femoral neuralgia, but it's still paresthesia, dysesthesia, and weakness in that leg. But hopefully that will improve once time goes by and the surgical wound heals. I have an appointment coming up. It'll be, you know, they want you to have a 2-week follow-up. My follow-up will be a week and a half, but that's okay. So my follow-up's on Erev Yom Kippur. So that happens next week. So I'll talk to Tamika and or Dr. Lantner about what my prospects are. And maybe I'll have some improvement in the next couple of days. Beth, who is the receptionist and partner of my chiropractor, Dr. Scott Gregor, said to me that day 8 is the magic day. Day 8, lots of good things happen, that you turn a corner on that day. I have not reached day 8. And I asked Nancy, so what day is day 8? Is that, what's day 1? Is that the day of the surgery or the day after the surgery? She said the day after. So day 8 is Saturday. So that's a couple of days from now. So hopefully on Saturday, I will turn some kind of a corner, and I will be looking forward to that. Meanwhile, lots of rest, reading books, catching up on TV, getting up and down, doing very gentle activities, which included a little bit of shopping. I went to a cupcake for later, and I got their pistachio, their Dubai dessert, which if you get any dessert that says Dubai on it, expect chocolate, and expect it to be delicious, expect chocolate and pistachio, and expect to pay a lot of money. So if you get Dubai anything, whether it's a chocolate bar or a dessert or a baklava or whatever, it's going to cost a lot, because pistachio, chocolate, the idea, whatever. But I got one of those desserts, and it's so rich, I can only have a few bites on a given day. So I think I'll have that dessert in the fridge for, 3 or 4 or 5 days, because I just can't eat a lot of it at once. But it was a fun thing to do. And, the bench shop is closing, so the last day of the bench shop is Tuesday, September 30th. So if you want to go to the bench shop, it's almost, you can go do that, and your last chance is in the next few days. So I went there and grabbed a few things. I started my holiday shopping in September. Why not? And so that was good. So I got that done. But it involved a mild amount of walking around, which is what I needed to do. And then, of course, drinking lots of water, drinking lots of water, tea, herb tea, a protein shake, a little bit of juice. So I'm hydrating. So that's good. And so that's what happened. So I'm on the mend. I'm healing. I'll keep you posted as to how it's going. I hope that this pain is good enough so that I can work next week. If I'm still pretty sore, I'll work virtually next week. If I had to work today, it would have to be virtually, because the discomfort is, it's enough to make me not want to sit for too long and to want to take breaks. And that's what they told me it would be like. I would be able to work part-time this week, which is exactly what I'm doing, because I'm just going in and doing charts. And it's not too stressful because I'm not actually directly seeing patients. So that's what happened. So let's hope that this is that'll have good news to report. I'm going to make my next show in a week and a half, so hopefully a lot of healing will have happened in that time. All right, so I bet you're wondering if Tylenol causes autism, right? Because that's been in the news. It's a big deal. Our president came out and said that if you are pregnant, don't take it. And he just said it about 10 times, don't take Tylenol, which upset Tylenol, the makers of Tylenol. So I'm taking a lot of Tylenol right now, and because it is a pain reliever. I'm not supposed to take anti-inflammatories because you need a certain level of inflammation to have post-surgical healing. So I'm on, the only anti-inflammatories I'm on are natural. So I have fish oil on board. I have evening primrose oil. I have curcumin on board. I have a lot of antioxidants on board, and I have not been bleeding excessively. So that there was a little bit of blood on the dressing when I took it off. So I'm doing well as far as that goes. But when you're post-surgical, they don't have you take anti-inflammatories. They have you take things that are pain relieving, and cannabis is actually partially anti-inflammatory. So I prefer to take that over opioids. Opioids are not anti-inflammatory. They just relieve pain and they knock you out. And I don't feel like I'm in enough pain to even need the opioids, because I can sit and relax and mostly be out of pain. It's when I change positions or I stand for a long time or walk for a long time, that's when I feel discomfort. But I can get out of it and then I can sleep. I didn't sleep the first night between the dexamethasone, I think, And the trauma of the surgery, I really didn't sleep very well the first night. Thankfully, the second night, I did. I crashed out the second night before 9 o'clock, which was great. So I slept through the night, and I've been sleeping fine since then. So that's really good. Anyway, so you're probably wondering if Tylenol causes autism. So the deal is, one of the things that happens is, I think that my opinion is that I don't want to say anything terrible, but RFK Jr. is not super educated in terms of health. Like, he's not a physician. He doesn't have a good scientific background. He has kind of an elevated lay background in scientific stuff and natural medicine. So the thing is, they're trying to find a magic bullet that will cure autism. And I don't think it works like that. So my understanding of autism spectrum disorders is, now, if you have an autism spectrum disorder, you are more likely to have methylation defects. So you might have a change in your MTHFR gene, methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, so that it makes it so that you don't convert your folic acid to activated folic acid as easily. So remember, one of the things that they're throwing around is this idea of taking leucovorin. Leucovorin is another name for folinic acid, or L5-MTHF. It's methylated folic acid. And I will give that to patients in the spectrum if I think they need it and might benefit from it. And if I find out they have a methylation defect, then I will certainly offer it to them. And, you know, the doses vary. You can give a very low dose. You can give 500 micrograms a day, and you can give 1,000 micrograms a day, and you can give 15 milligrams in a day. And I don't know if that's a good idea. I mean, I would prefer to balance my methylators to help with that. Anyway, so the point is that they're thinking that if you are pregnant and you take Tylenol, you're going to cause autism in your child. It's not a causation of autism, as far as I understand. That autism is a way of being. Autism is genetic, basically. And when you talk about autism, it's not one thing. It's a spectrum of disorders, and people present very differently in terms of how they express their autism. And attention deficit disorder is in the autism spectrum. So people can be very functional in the world, and they can be minimally functional in the world, and they can be anything in between. So when a person in the spectrum comes in to see me, I look at them like I look at anybody else. I treat the whole person. I find out what's going on with that person, and we work with what's going on with them specifically. Like, do they need help with methylation? Do they need low-dose lithium? Do they need methylators? Do they need support for their digestion? Are they eating a good diet? Are they not eating a good diet? So you have to figure out what's going on with that person and what the person's goals are. And you can't just treat them like they're a cookie cutter, because people come in on the spectrum with all different presentations. So what's the idea that acetaminophen can lead to autism? Well, one of the ideas is that when you take acetaminophen, it's very hard. It's hard on your liver. It can cause liver damage. That's why I'm taking less than 4,000 milligrams a day. In fact, I'm mostly taking probably 15. I'm taking a little over 2,000 milligrams a day, and that's it. And that's all I seem to need. So if you keep it under 4,000, you're okay. And then as my pain gets better, I'm going to wean off it. I'm going to stop taking it mostly. And if you take some of the other things, you don't have to take as much acetaminophen. Anyway, so the thing is that acetaminophen, when it breaks down, it taxes the glutathione system in your liver. So glutathione, there are metabolites of acetaminophen that get broken when you break down the acetaminophen in your body by your liver. It gets broken down into a metabolite that your glutathione goes after. And glutathione is a great detoxifier. And so Glutathione will detoxify. It's a great detoxifier and antioxidant. So if there are toxins going on in your body from your everyday metabolism, from stuff you breathe in from the environment, from stuff you eat, you need your glutathione as one of the things to help manage that. So you have less glutathione function if you're taking Tylenol. And if that's going on and your gestating fetus has genetics for autism, and then they're exposed to more environmental toxins, then there's a chance they're more likely to have genetic expression that leads to the symptoms of autism. So taking Tylenol is not going to be a cause of autism, but it could be a factor. Just like anything else you do, any other medications that you take could be a factor, anything you've been exposed to, anything that you eat, if it causes inflammation, any inflammatory event that you have can potentially make you more likely to bring on the genes that cause an inflammatory condition and bring on the genes that cause what presents as autism. So to say that Tylenol is the smoking gun and that's it is ridiculous. I mean, and the other thing is, if you have a fever, because they get concerned about fevers in women who are pregnant, if you're feverish and you have a gestating baby on board, it can be harmful to the baby. So if you take Tylenol, Tylenol helps reduce fevers. So that's one of the reasons that they give it, you know, for pain and fever. If you take it once or twice during your pregnancy, it's probably not going to do anything. Also, if you are eating a really good diet, if you're eating a diet that's high in sulfur-bearing compounds, so say you're eating a lot of cruciferous vegetables, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean protein, and you're just eating in general a healthy diet, then you're going to produce enough glutathione to offset any Tylenol that you took. Now, if you're taking a lot of Tylenol every single day, that's probably not a good idea. That probably can lead to more problems because it is taxing to the liver, and you could have less glutathione function, which could then lead to more toxins and metabolites being around that could lead to, it's not that it's causing autism. It's not this, then that. The thing that causes the autism is the person is genetically predisposed, and it's not one gene, it's a bunch of stuff. And then some of the genes get flipped on when they experience oxidative stress. And how do you experience oxidative stress? By taking environmental toxins, by having inflammation, by having metabolites in your body that lead to inflammation and disordered gene expression. But that's what's going on. It's basically the gene expression. If the gene expression comes out a certain way, you can present as ADHD or with autism. And so could Tylenol be a factor in that? Yes, but so could a lot of things. And if you have Tylenol once or twice in your pregnancy, it's probably not going to do anything, especially if you're eating a clean diet. If you're taking Tylenol every day and not eating a clean diet, well, is it the Tylenol or is it all the other stuff that you're doing? So obviously, if you are pregnant and you are concerned about whether you can take Tylenol or not, because you might want to at some point, the best thing to do is to talk to your caregiver, whoever is taking care of your pre-gestation, your gestational care. So your midwife, your lay midwife, your certified nurse midwife, your obstetrician, gynecologist, whoever is taking care of you, talk to them about what's going on in your specific case. Is it okay to use? And what can you do around it? And I will say, now again, don't listen to me because I'm just giving you general information for knowledge's sake, that you need to consult with a practitioner when you're dealing with all this stuff. But I would say it could be helpful if you're taking Tylenol to also be eating a lot of cruciferous vegetables. So you're talking about broccoli and cabbage and turnip greens and collards and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower. Those are all cruciferous vegetables, and they have sulfur-bearing compounds in them, which can help you to make more glutathione. I'm not saying that is going to definitely help you. Again, that this might be a thing that is helpful, understanding the science behind it, because if you're eating foods that have sulfur-bearing compounds in them that are known to help with detoxification, that could be helpful for you. So you might want to consider doing that. There's probably no harm, and unless you have problems eating cruciferous vegetables. Some people do. Some people get terrible gas eating cruciferous vegetables. And if that's you, obviously don't do it. But in any case, the best thing for you to do is if you feel that you're going to need a fever reducer or a pain reliever while you are pregnant, the best thing to do is to talk to your provider, talk to your gestational care provider, whether it's your certified nurse midwife, your lay midwife, your certified professional midwife, or your obstetrician gynecologist, and they will give you advice about that. And I would say that in general, too much in the way of pharmaceuticals during pregnancy is not a good thing. There are certain things that people continue to take. I believe that, you know, if people have psychiatric issues, they have to continue taking some of their psychiatric meds, for example, SSRIs, like your Zoloft and your Prozac, your fluoxetine and your sertraline, that you need to still take those during pregnancy, because if you are depending on them to keep your mood stable, you're still going to need those when you're pregnant. So in any case, anything that you take can affect your pregnancy. And generally, when you're pregnant, you mostly try not to take anything. And we have you back off on a lot of your supplements, too. And when you're pregnant, there's only a few things that we recommend that you take. Of course, you can take your prenatal vitamin. Everything that's in the prenatal vitamin has been approved for pregnancy. And that's just going to be basic vitamins and minerals. I will have women take magnesium during pregnancy. That's a good thing to have on board. It's not harmful, and it can relax sore muscles. It can help with sleep. It can help with anxiety. You can take fish oil. So fish oil is helpful. Fish oil, EPA and DHA, the omega-3 fatty acids that are high in fish oil, are really good for baby's brain development, and they also help to reduce inflammation and pain. And you can take a probiotic. If you want to take a probiotic, you can. And you can also eat fermented foods like real sauerkraut, real pickles, yogurt, whether it's dairy-free or containing dairy. That's something you can do as well. And then in terms of teas, you can drink a little caffeine. I think you have to keep it under 400 milligrams of caffeine a day. And 400 milligrams of caffeine is way too much for me, and I've never been pregnant. So you can have a cup of coffee. You can have a cup of coffee, you can have a cup of tea, you can have a little bit of caffeine, if you want to and you tolerate it. Less is probably better, but the cutoff is 400 milligrams. And you can have, in terms of herb teas, two of the big ones we recommend are nettles and raspberry leaf, because they are helpful. Nettles is very nutritious. It doesn't have any hormonal interfering activity. And it has a lot of vitamins and minerals in it. And then raspberry leaf tea also has things that are tonifying for pregnancy and is not harmful in pregnancy. So, and that's pretty much all we have you do. And the other thing is, if you can do things that are not taking drugs for pain, that's a great thing to do. Like if you could put cold packs on your head or the back of your neck, if you can get massage, if you can get acupuncture, if you can do cold, if you have pain in your back, if you can do cold packs on your back, you can also go get chiropractic. So these are all things you can do during pregnancy that are not taking a pill. Getting rest. You can do stretches. You can do yoga. You can certainly do pregnancy yoga if you want to. There's all kinds of things you can do for pain short of taking a pill for the pain. So definitely things that you can try. All right, so there you go. So is autism caused by Tylenol? I would say not directly. And if you have to take a little bit of Tylenol, it's probably okay. And do consult with your gestational care provider before you go ahead and take it. All right, so let's talk about a couple other things. We have a little less than about 15 minutes left. So let's see. Oh, maybe you want to know about Ron. Ron is okay. He's doing well. He still gets sore at the end of the day. And he went to the neurosurgeon. He said he can get back on his bike. So he's psyched about that. I'm not sure what that will look like, when he will get back on his bike and for how long and what, because he's not feeling very strong. So anyway, so that's what's going on with Ron. Okay. Did you know that people eat more sugar because of climate change? So why would they do that? It says, as the world gets hotter, Americans are turning to more sugar. And that a study was done, and they found that. So we found that global warming in the U.S. is amping up the current country's sweet tooth. When the temperature rises, Americans, especially those with not a lot of money and education, drink more sugary beverages and a bit more and eat more frozen desserts. So that's like more than 100 million pounds of added sugar consumed in the nation in a year compared to 15 years ago. And this was studied in the U.S. and the United Kingdom. When the temperatures go between 54 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 12 and 30 degrees Celsius, the amount of sugar the average American consumes goes up by about 0.4 grams per degree Fahrenheit. That's 0.7 grams per degree Celsius a day, based on researchers' tracking of weather conditions and consumer purchases. At 54 degrees, the amount of added sugar for the average American is a little more than 2 grams, and at 86 degrees, it's 15 grams. Wow! So what goes on there? Beyond that, appetites lessen and added sugar falls off. So beyond 86 degrees, you lose your appetite because it's too hot to eat. And so the added sugar falls off. Climate change is shaping what you eat and how you eat, and that might have a bad effect on your health, said one of the study's co-authors. People tend to take in more sweetened beverages as the temperatures get higher. Obviously, under a warming climate, that would cause you to drink or take in more sugar, and that's going to be a severe problem when it comes to health. And if you have a little sugar every day, it tends to add up. The daily difference from higher temperatures don't amount to even a single candy bar for the average person, but it does add up over time and can have a big effect. Dr. Lustig, who studied this at the University of California, says that among poorer Americans, one added can of sugary soft drink a day increases diabetes risk by 29%, and temperature-related thirst plays a big part in America's obesity epidemic, because we tend to drink, you know, soda. So at soda and those sweet beverages from the cafe. So to chart the impact on sugar consumption, researchers compared it to the American Heart Association recommendations. You're supposed to limit your daily intake to 36 grams for men and 25 for women. The team then compared wind, precipitation, and humidity records to detailed purchase records of 40 to 60,000 American households from 2004 to 2019, not using any data after the pandemic hit, because the pandemic just messed things up. People ate a lot more of all kinds of things during the pandemic. Then they looked at the nutritional information of the items bought, and that allowed them to eliminate other factors to make a causal link and come up with a calculation for how much extra sugar is consumed per person per degree. So Dr. Hay said she started thinking about the study when she noticed that people in the U.S. tend to grab sugary soda when they're thirsty. From a perspective of nutrition science or environmental science, that could be a problem. The daily difference from higher temperatures doesn't amount to even a single candy bar. I'm repeating this. So the U.S.'s average annual temperature has gone up about 2.2 degrees since 1895. To chart the impact on sugar consumption, they compared it to the American Heart Association recommendations. So men tend to consume more sugary soft drinks, and that the amount of added sugar consumed during hot weather was several times higher for low and very low-income families. And people who work outside drink more sugary drinks than those who work indoors. And the same went for families where the head of the household was less educated. White people have the highest added sugar effect, while Asians showed no significant change to added sugar in the heat. Sugary drinks are marketed and priced in a way to attract the poor, that was shown in the study. And many disadvantaged communities, the water tastes funny because of chemicals. Poor people are also less likely to have air conditioning and are more likely to work outside and need more hydration. It should concern us that the rate of the impact is larger in households where people make less money or are less educated. These groups tend to have lower baseline health status, so this is an area where climate-related change appears to magnify existing health inequalities. So the amount of sugar consumed is likely to soar in the future with more warming, but University of Washington health and climate scientist Christy Ebby, who wasn't part of the research, says as temperatures increase with human-caused climate change, there will be other issues of more importance than a small increase in sugary beverages. So you tend to eat more, you tend to consume more sugar as the temperature goes up, which is very interesting. So I think people tend to be out and about more. It talks about how people are working outside and they get very hot. And let's face it, if you are a person who likes bubbly drinks are refreshing, and they're especially refreshing if you're very hot. So you might be more likely to drink something fizzy, and fizzy things that you tend to get are going to be full of sugar. And the other thing you might tend to get is one of those drinks at the cafe that's on the sweet side, a big, great big iced drink, and it might have a lot of calories in it. And the other thing you're more likely to do when it's hot out is go get ice cream. And people love to get their ice cream, and people tend not to get as much ice cream the lower the temperatures. I mean, I don't feel like eating ice cream when it's really cold out. Ron always does, which is interesting because he tends to be cold, but he will eat ice cream any time of year. It's funny. And I tend to get less interested in it the colder it is out. And so it's interesting. So if you're getting hot, try to think about, and you need to hydrate, and you don't want to just drink plain water, then get fizzy water. See if you can develop a taste for fizzy water, water that has no calories. It might have some flavoring in it or not. And you can get flavored fizzy water, and you can get fizzy water that has a splash of fruit juice in it. And you can also get fizzy water and put your own stuff in it. You can put your own fruit or herbs or anything that you like to make it taste interesting. Another thing you can do is you can get a machine that you can have in your home, and you can have your own good quality water, and you can add carbonation to it. And you can add carbonation to any beverage. So I really like fizzy, and I also like iced tea. So if I were to mix seltzer and homemade iced tea, then the fizziness tends to get diluted. But if I had that machine that puts the carbonation in, I can make the iced tea as I like, and then I can add the carbonation to it, and now I have fizzy iced tea. And it's fizzy iced tea the way that I like it, you know, with my own choice of tea bags and my own level of lemon and just a little bit of added sweetener. So that's a way to do it too. And you know, there's certainly lots of lower calorie ways to make homemade drinks. You can make lattes at home and have just a little bit of milk and lots of cinnamon and just a little bit of sweetener. It's going to be a lot less sweet than something that you got at the cafe. And you also don't have to have a huge one every time, you know, a 20 plus ouncer every time. You can make 20 plus ounces of latte, put it in the refrigerator, and maybe today you'll sip off 5 ounces of that, and maybe tomorrow you'll sip off another 5 ounces, and have it for a few days, and don't have so much. I mean, that's one of the ways to do it. When you make stuff at home, you tend to make smaller portions, or if you make a big portion, you can save it in the refrigerator and just have it over a couple of days. I do that anyway. If I get a big green tea latte at a cafe, I generally don't finish it, and it goes in the fridge, and then I sip the rest of it over a couple of days. Same with bubble tea. Any drink that I get out, I tend to do that. Not alcoholic drinks, and I don't get a lot of those. So there's definitely solutions for this, ways to keep you cooler. You definitely want to continue to hydrate. Doing water with electrolytes is a good idea. And of course, the simplest electrolyte is a pinch of sea salt and a splash of your favorite fruit juice. Top it off with water and ice it if you want ice. And now you have a refreshing drink. So it's not necessary to drink excessively sugary drinks. And you have to figure out what some alternatives are. And there are great recipes for alternative drinks too, like a refresher style drink where you put a tiny bit of fruit juice in, a whole bunch of fruit, and you know, water and ice and maybe herbs, and you have something delicious. So try to think about that, and just be mindful about whether you're drinking. If you're drinking a sugary beverage, just notice that you're doing it and what the circumstances are, and try not to do it so much. Maybe do it on a day when you've got a lot of exercise. I'm not saying that you should never go to the cafe and get one of those wonderful drinks, but it might be a good idea to cut back on it and think about when you're doing it, and can you do it on a day when you've got more activity so you can burn it off more. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is just to review why fish oil is so good for you. Fish oil is good for you. There's 11 benefits, and I don't think we're going to get through them all because it's almost time to wrap it up. So it's an excellent source of omega-3s, which is good for your heart and your brain. And getting your omega-3s from fish is even healthier. But if you don't eat fish, fish oil is a good alternative. It's one of the most commonly consumed dietary supplements. I certainly recommend it very frequently. It's rich in omega-3 fatty acids, which are very important for your health, because a lot of people don't eat fish. They don't like to eat fish at all. So I see a lot of patients who are, fish is gross. And when I get them to take fish oil, they have to take it in pills. They won't take the actual liquid fish oil. I take liquid fish oil. I don't mind it. And I also eat fish, almost every day, and I take fish oil every day. Here's 12 benefits of fish oil. It's extracted from oily fish, and it's extracted from smash fish. So remember what the smash fish are? Smash fish are fish that are high in omega-3 fatty acids and low in mercury. And smash, they're not smashed, although you can smash them if you like. That's the funny thing. I think a couple of them you do kind of eat smashed. So one of them is salmon. So SMASH is an acronym that stands for salmon, mackerel, anchovies, sardines, and herring. And all of those are high in omega-3 fatty acids and low in mercury because they're small. Well, some of them are small. Salmon can be big, but salmon don't spend a lot of time in the ocean, so they don't have a way to onboard mercury. So they tend to be low in mercury, but they're wonderfully high in omega-3 fatty acids. They spend time, most of the time, in fresh water, but they go to the ocean before they spawn. They spend time in the ocean, and then they get that wonderful cold water omega-3 fatty acids. The other fish you do catch in the ocean, but they're small, so they have no time to bioaccumulate mercury. So, you know, mackerel are not very big. Mackerel are not tiny fish. Like, anchovies are little, and anchovies and herring, they're small fish, whereas salmon can be pretty big, and mackerel is a sort of medium size. What do we say? Anchovies and sardines are little, as you can see them in the can. They're tiny. They're maybe an inch or inch and a half long. So that's what fish oil is made from. Fish oil is generally made from smash fish. It's made from herring, tuna. Generally not tuna. The fish oil I get, this says tuna, but that's generally not the case. When I get fish oil, the fish oil that I have in my office is generally made from herring, anchovies, and mackerel. No tuna. You don't want to use tuna because you're concerned about the level of mercury that's in it. Now, my buddy Paul at the fish market says that he gets smaller tuna so that their bioaccumulation of mercury is going to be minimal. And he says, make sure you eat foods with selenium in them because the glutathione is going to help you get rid of the mackerel. And in the Seychelles, they eat a lot of mercury-bearing fish, but they also eat a high level of selenium so they don't have mercury toxicity. So that's all I have. I'm going to have to talk about this, why fish oil is good for you, next week, because we are out of time. So that was great. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is busy doing other things. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND, for 30 days. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.